Hello and welcome to the Monocle Culture Show. I'm Robert Bounds. On this week's episode, we're shining our spotlight on the new album by the British musician Anna Calvi. This is her third LP. It's called Hunter, and it came out last Friday on Domino Records. And joining me in this listening party in the studio are the journalist Sophie Brown and the writer and broadcaster Kate Hutchinson. Anna Calvi was brought to our attention back in 2011 when she released her debut eponymous LP, which she followed up with 2013's One Breath, both of which were nominated for the Mercury Music Prize. Calvi is known for her rich, slick and cinematic rock music, powered by her operatic voice and virtuoso guitar playing. As an artist who struggled to pinpoint a female guitarist role model while she was growing up, she's one of an increasing number of women picking up their Stratocasters and shaking up an often male-dominated genre, and paving the way for a whole new generation of guitarists to have plenty to be inspired by. I wanted to survive nothing. Anna Calvi's new album is called Hunter, and true to form, it's big in voice and volume. She's accompanied by swaggering guitars, glistening harps and thumping drums that sound as if she's heading into battle. But battle against what? Well, Calvi is mostly tackling the ideas and limitations of gender stereotypes through songs such as As a Man and Don't Beat the Girl Out of My Boy. Don't beat the girl. Fresh from Hunter by Anna Calvi. Kate and Sophie, welcome to the programme.
Hi.
Nice to have you in the studio. We're all new friends here, aren't we, today?
Yes.
This is untried, untested, but I can feel it's got the shimmer of quality about it already.
The magic is going to happen.
Kate, we wanted to put a spoiler. You're a little hoarse after a weekend in the country.
It's true.
It sounds like the way I've said it, like you were kind of judging a Gymkhana.
Oh, thanks.
That's not the case.
Yeah, I was hosting a weekend of talks at Lost Village Festival. I co-curate a tent called the Institute of Curious Minds, and we had everything from how to upgrade your orgasm to Ganjanomics to the future of money to when Black Mirror becomes real life. And I tell you what, I mean, it really has given my vocal cords a workout, as you can tell.
Well, we're lucky to have you here to embrace you on the Culture Show here then today.
I made it.
You kind of talked out, but not. You've got half an hour left in you yet. Sophie, lovely to have you in the studio as well. I'm going to kick off with you. This wonderful new record from Anna Calvi, it's called Hunter. The title itself is a statement of intent. It's very much about enjoying being the chase, but being the chaser too, right?
Yeah, it has a really powerful, dramatic kind of sexual sense to it that's really great to listen to. And the way that in Hunter specifically, there's a lot of kind of heavy breathing throughout, which kind of reminds me of a lot of Prince songs like Little Red Corvette or the way that he, because her ideas about the things that she's exploring in Hunter are gender and role play and experimenting with being both man and woman. That reminds me of what Prince does with, like, I Would Die For You, when he's like, I'm not a woman, I'm not a man, I'm something you'll never understand.
Yeah, there's something about the playing of the record as well as the lyrics. There's a bit of didacticism, we'll come to that. There's a bit of this is how things might be, with her lyrical intent. But the playing on this record, Kate, is amazing, right? She's always been a strong performer, but this feels, I mean, I've said this is easily her best record. It's an amazing thing, right?
Definitely. I think with the first two Anna Calvi records, Her hair was tied back quite tautly. She was going for this sort of matador look, and she was really kind of playing with this sort of androgynous vibe and kind of trying to sort of, I guess, perform masculinity a bit more. With this, there's a real sense of loosening. And like Sophie, like you said, like really kind of letting go. I mean, from the image on her record, which is taken by Maisie Williams, where she's got this dewy, sort of sweaty, kind of almost post-sex look with her hair's all tussly. And like you said, the sound, there's this real sort of bursting forth, a sort of carnal energy. It's sensuous, it's red, it's primal. And the guitar feels just howling, like she's really expressing herself more through that guitar sound this time.
On the first listen, it kind of reminded me of PJ Harvey, actually, some of that crunchy guitar and that kind of real, the glorying in the sort of femininity of it, but then being tough as nails as well somehow.
Well, I feel a bit sorry for Anna Calvi in a way, because she's always made
one of a million comparisons to Polly Harvey.
Well, she's always going to have the PJ Harvey sort of chain around her ankles, really, because yes, she is a woman, and yes, she has an androgynous vibe about her, and yes, she plays guitar, and also she hasn't made it easy for herself for the fact that she's included a lot of red imagery, which I definitely associate with Polly Jean Harvey. But for this record specifically, I would say that this is her most Nick Cave record. I think on tracks like Chain and on Wish, her vocal sound really has that sort of noirish Nick Cave warble. Mm-hmm. And also this record is produced by one of the Nick Cave and the Bad Season Grinderman collaborators, Nick Launay, I think I'm saying his name right. So there is really that strong Nick Cave and the Bad Seas connection on this record. And I also know from reading interviews with her that she's seen Nick Cave perform recently, especially with Stagger Lee and with the last track that he does in his latest performance with the band, Push the Sky Away, where it's just this intense performance, this real kind of emotion that you're getting through his very controlled vocal. So really, I would say it was more of her Nick Cave record than her Polly Jean Harvey record.
That Stagger Lee is exactly what I was thinking about too, in the way that when he performs those songs and he gets the stage flooded with all the people, he's just so dramatic, and he silences and whispers like Anna Calvi does, and there's this like building kind of really tense emotional power.
And something super sexual about it as well, right? Not just the swagger of the performer, but the nature of those songs as well. And some of the songs that we're talking about today, sort of super sexual. Yeah, there's songs about identity and all the rest of it. But as we say, going back to the title, there is that thing of, because I'm a woman, I'm not the hunted, I'm the hunter. I'm kind of, she's grabbing stuff. She's grabbing the bull by the horns.
Definitely.
And other parts of the anatomy.
Well, absolutely.
Or no balls at all. No balls need apply, perhaps.
Well, it's a gender-fluid utopia that Anna Calvi is painting with
Yes.
Hunter. I think what was really interesting for me was that track Chain, where Anna sort of adopts the persona of this dominant female lover pushing her lover into the back seat of the car and saying, like, I'm going to ravage you and take your breath. Don't breathe. I haven't heard that sort of narrative in indie rock, or certainly not in pop music, but certainly not in indie rock either. I can't remember last time I've heard something like that. And that is really powerful. I think, like I said, there's this real sense of sort of unbridled sexual energy with this record. Anna has really just, I mean, it's the first record where she's come out with this record. You know, she's kind of said, I'm queer on this record. She's talking about her girlfriend in interviews, and she's really just playing with that. And there's a real sense of freeing. She is breaking those chains that she speaks about. There's real freeness with this record, I think.
Yeah, it really feels like that, right? It's kind of, as we said, this after two kind of, you can't call them trial runs, they're really good records, but
they
had a kind of gauze over them somehow. I know what you meant, they felt restrained somehow. This one's kind of all guns kind of blazing.
Absolutely.
And presumably as a lyricist and as a musician, being able to be honest about with your public about who you are and about the nature of the songs you're writing and the reason why those lyrics exist and these chords exist and all the rest of it must be hugely freeing. Sophie, how does it's tough maybe as an intention as a songwriter to get that primal, all the primal feelings you feel onto the record. How has she achieved this, do you think? We talked about the Grinder Man and Bad Seeds producer. I think Martin Casey also plays with the Bad Seeds guests on this record. How does Anna Calvi get this kind of rawness and redness and kind of tooth and claw sexually and creatively onto the record, do you think?
I think partly it's a really kind of operatic thing that she does. It's this really emotive sense of release that turns the feeling and sound of the voice and the words are more important than what she's actually saying at some points. It kind of reminds me of Cocteau Twins or something, yeah, like their Cherry Coloured Funk or Pearly Dewdrops Drops, in which they're just singing about when Roddy comes. But the way that they're singing it is just this really moody, kind of tempestuous and ethereal, kind of creating another world.
I think the penultimate track is Away, and then that's suddenly a cut in this record. I mean, it's 10 tracks long. We should applaud its brevity and its 10-trackedness. Mm. It's a rare thing sometimes when people always want to have 15 tracks in it. But that's a kind of bit more of a kind of gossamer moment on quite a visceral record.
There is no shadow.
There's quite a lot of gossamer moments, I think, because she's playing with this idea of utopia, and that's really reflected in some of the lovely sounds that you hear. There's a track called Swimming Pool.
Shadows of light, shadows divide on the earth.
Again, that has that very gossamer quality. And I like this idea that she's playing with, that her utopia is where the gender binary doesn't exist. I also wanted to mention, though, about how she's translating these sort of themes to the album. The album has a real physicality about the sounds. So, Sophie, you mentioned her operatic singing. I think that the shapes that she's making with her vocals, and then this very contrast of this very kind of sinuous, I can't even say this word, sinewy guitars, that the guitar lines, that kind of rhythm is very kind of slinky. And that is reflected in the video for Don't Beat the Girl Out of My Boy, where she has got this choreographed video where this woman behind her is touching her face and there's flesh being grabbed and she's got dancers and their bodies are all sort of moulding into each other. I think it's very clever how she's continued that theme and made it work across the sound of the album and also the visuals too.
She did an interview recently and she called Rock and Roll a Man's Story, which I guess has kind of been fair enough, the majority of it. And she and I think she asked a question in that interview of whether the future is female, or maybe the journalist asked whether the future of rock and roll is female. It seems like there are obviously fewer boys in skinny jeans and leather jackets making commercially successful guitar music, but lots of women are doing it. And there's something also seems to be associated with the idea of maybe queer women doing it, and it being a kind of, I don't know, that's a signal of intent. Maybe that's a kind of boys' reading of it. But I look at artists like St. Vincent. I see strong, brilliant songwriters with guitars standing centre stage, and Anna Calvi is one such. Is that fair to say? Is there a movement? Is that a movement, or is that just wishful thinking?
I'm sorry to say that I don't think that men in vacuum-packed trousers playing guitars with mop-top haircuts are ever really going to go away. I think for every Anna Calvi and Nadine Shah, there'll be a cabbage.
okay.
You know, yeah. And, you know, I also think there's loads of guys making really interesting guitar music at the moment, like Shame, like Happy Meal Limited, yeah, etc. But I do think it is really exciting that there is this kind of shift or this move towards women in pop, women in guitar music, reclaiming their narrative and really putting their sexuality front and centre without any kind of inhibitions about that. So certainly with rock music, or, I mean, why use these genre terms? Certainly in music, we've seen St. Vincent. We've got Marika Hatman with I'm Not Your Man, which is a really, really great record. And then sort of within the more sort of poppy electronic arena. We've had Fever Ray's Plunge. We've had, we're going to have Christine and the Queens' Chris coming out in a couple of weeks. I think it's just a really exciting time. It's better to look at it like that rather than, you know, pitching the genders against each other. But I definitely think we're going to see more women coming through. There's just more appetite for that.
I think I'm really enjoying at the moment, most of the people I'm listening to are like making really brilliant and exciting queer music, like the new Blood Orange album, Negro Swan, or the Janelle Monáe album. Absolutely. And Courtney Barnett. Like, and it's great to hear all that kind of stuff and the fluidity.
Why is that? Is that because we're finding something that's very honest and is about themselves to sing about, and they're maybe writing better stuff because of it? Because it's not just another theme. We're told that gender and sexuality should not be the most interesting thing about somebody, but it's kind of also often been the basis of boy meets girl rock song. When that's inverted or subverted or whatever it is, that can't help but be interesting. But why, I wonder, is there such a rich seam of sort of fluidity around music at the moment, I wonder?
I think it's changing social mores. I mean, music is a mirror to society, or it should be a mirror to society and what's going on. And what's going on is that there is a young generation, or the new generation of music fans coming through, for whom gender fluidity, whatever you want to call it, is very much prominent in their lives. You know, they're LGBTQI literate. They are woked, for want of a better phrase, to issues of racial divides and marginalised voices, and they want to put those to the fore. So I really think that this is a reflection of a changing sort of changing young people of Generation Z or Z or whatever. But my concern is, with an album like Anna Calvi's, is that people are going to raise an eyebrow and say, oh, well, isn't it just a perfect timing that we're in this sort of new dawn for queer music? And Anna Calvi's, that's my fear, is that people are going to start to see these sorts of records as just fitting in with the trend. And I don't think that's the case with Anna Calvi's at all.
It's a strange thing when someone has probably been biding their time in order to have the confidence to be who they are, and yet they can be accused of jumping on a bandwagon as if it's a genre of music, like hip-hop or rock music is, or something.
But, there will be.
Yeah, no,
you know,
can imagine
it happened with mental health, you know, which was a very, very important thing for musicians to start talking about and singing about. But then the trickle-down effect is that you get this hashtag culture where pop stars put together by a major label machine, not to take anything away from that, but just to give one example, start hashtagging around these kind of issues. I mean, there is always going to be that trickle-down effect and that knock-on effect, but yeah, I think with Anna Calvi's, it's very much, it feels authentic. And also it feels different. She's singing about things that's different to Janelle Monáe and different to Marika Hackman. They're not all the same. We can't just kind of use the queer pop or queer rock brush with this.
Kate, there, I'm doing a great brushing action.
Just painting.
She's
the
using
walls.
Just using the gender brush there.
Everything's
in
spread.
Studio two. Yeah, it's fine. This is now time. We kind of take a little. You guys are new to this, but this is where we kind of take a. We take five and we look at our further reading. And what are the things that maybe when you were reviewing this record, it reminded you of, or what are the books that you took off the shelf to kind of help with it? Sophie, you wanted to talk about David Lynch. You feel there is a Lynchian element to Anna Calvi's new record. Tell us what you're talking about with this.
Yeah, definitely. I think particularly in that track Hunter, the sort of the deep resonating guitar twangs are very kind of falling Twin Peaks style. And something for David Lynch that's very important is sound and the power of voice. And it's often voice is a way of opening a passageway between the living and the dead. And it also has a very operatic presence. There's things like in Twin Peaks, Laura, her absence is felt through different sounds, like a minor bird repeating her voice, or the falling theme that comes through. Or you have in Mulholland Drive the moment where they have this woman singing, that kind of very operatta, or she's doing a version of Crying, the Roy Orbison song, and the women watching burst into tears and they disappear, and there's this sort of very rich sense. I suppose it reminds me a bit of the myth of Orpheus and the idea that he went to try and rescue his wife by the power of song, and the idea that that melody would open up like this space and a connection between the living and the dead. And in the way that Anna Calvi's sounds, particularly on this album, has a very strong, haunting, like wailing, howling power that's also like this. In Finland, they have a tradition of Finnish lament where they'd have this kind of mourning song that the voice would try and guide the person who died to the afterlife. It's just like that kind of intensity, I think, really comes through.
Wow, I love that. Yeah, that's a deep reading of it, right? I love that. It's a bit like the that sense of fado, you know, the Portuguese music that was written for, sung by women, and it was because their men ran away for 10 years at sea at a time, and it was the kind of like amazing specific sense of loss, the song to the sort of lost mariner or the missed mariner kind of thing. There's something kind of amazing about that. And also in Mulholland Drive, loads of heavy breathing. We talked about the breathing and the kind of sensuality and some of the aggression of it. There's some of that with that funny monster that they're chasing around half the time.
You often hear the thing with David Lynch as well is that images come from sound.
Yeah.
So you'll often hear a very unnerving sound and you won't be able to identify what it is, and slowly this very creepy thing will emerge. Or in Mulholland Drive, it's just these whirring industrial sounds that this guy's recalling his dream. And then if you don't have the sound on, like all you see is this grubby tramp just sliding out, and it's not scary. But with the power of all these like building up tensions, it's something else.
Just thinking about this, getting the hairs rising on the back of my neck. I hated that monster thing.
Yeah.
Is he a tramp? I think he's a monster.
No, I've paused it.
Oh, you paused it? Are you mad?
I've watched it without sound, and it's just you feel nothing, but that like the tension and the panic that builds up with those sounds is enough to make it the most terrifying image ever.
It's pretty. I don't think I could put that DVD on pause and look into that thing's eyes. Also, you mentioned what you described as the sensory logic of Wong Kar-wai's films and In the Mood for Love specifically, which has such a famous and wonderful soundtrack. What do you mean by the sensory logic of a film?
So with specifically In the Mood for Love, I mean, it has the cinematographer is Christopher Doyle, and his style with filmmaking or his cinematography is very lurid, kind of like a kind of hallucinogenic fantasy. And the way that the film builds the narrative, so it's about a couple, well, they're not a couple, it's Mrs. Chan and Chow, and their partners are having an affair, and they're trying to work out through role playing, like, what their partners are experiencing in their affair. And through this role-playing, they get closer. And the way that the film unfolds is very much sensory, in that it kind of captures how perception, when you're in heightened moments, how a memory is formed, like the screen vibrates with the rain coming down onto the ground, and there are all these very close-up shots of them like gripping the other one's hand and letting go, or these jump cuts that kind of explore internal emotional time and places that on top of an objective understanding of how the narrative is unfolding. So it kind of feels like everything has happened already in the film, but you're just experiencing all these little pieces of deep memory that are kind of replaying over and over, and it's very sexual as well. Like, there's a lot of,
it's so chaste and yet so sexual at the same time, isn't it, that movie? Yeah, you've certainly described it in such a way that I'm gonna go straight home and put that on. It's such a good film. Forgot about it for a while, right?
I'm gonna go and put my head in my hands. I can't follow that. I've left half my mind in a field, you know. That was brilliant. So interesting.
I left part of my brain in a field in Hampshire. Sophie, thank you for that, for the Lynchian themes and the Wong Kar-waiian themes. Kate, you wanted to kind of go more directly back to the Anna Calvi album and some sort of musical references and some kind of crunchy, chunky, grungy kind of 90s guitar.
Tool are one of those metal bands that get short... Well, they're just one of those bands that get short shrift because people think, oh, metal. But actually, they were a very kind of sensual, sexy metal band. And they were also playing with gender a bit, and they were definitely playing with sex and about kind of roles between the sexes. But I suppose when I listen to music like Anna Calvi's, I'm listening for what's different, and I'm listening for those things that stick out instrumentally. And in the track Indies in Paradise, for me, what really struck me as different was this very sort of slinky, metallic-y guitar sound that was a bit like, you know, if you walked into a bar and you saw someone you fancied, it was a bit like, I'm going to look at you and flirt at you. I'm going to wink at you and then I'm going to walk away. And then maybe I'll come back and then maybe I won't. And there's really nice mood lighting on my face. and I'm drinking a very gorgeous cocktail. That's how that felt for me.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very mercuried. And again, like, it wasn't surprising to hear that the producer had done Grinderman. Again, they had that very kind of great with abrasive sounds. But I brought up Tool because, to make a really lazy comparison, St. Vincent, who we mentioned earlier, another female guitarist who's playing with gender identity, she recently came out as being an adamant Tool fan when she was younger. And I just feel like perhaps this is
It's easy to say I'm a gay woman, but saying you're a Tool fan...
It's much more difficult. Very difficult. The judgment that you get. And anyway, so she made a video where she was playing some Tool instrumental on her guitar. And I just thought, that's great. Perhaps they're due, you know, a reappraisal. All these wonderful queer women are suddenly going to come out and say how much they love Tool.
I like this because also it's people who listen to the show also want to know where people who review records, where they listen to them, how that process takes place. So I kind of like the fact that you're like, and then I went through my CD collection, I went to Spotify, and I got seriously into Tool for like a couple of nights.
Well, sadly, Tool are not on Spotify, so the only way to listen to their music, I think,
your extensive...
is to buy it on CD, which feels very antiquated now. But yeah, I suppose when I review music, I'm always trying to see what's different lyrics aside, and that was really what stood out for me, certainly on that track.
And do you, just before we go, do you cross-reference when you're writing stuff down, you're like, oh, that reminds me of that, but I need to check that that is the lyric or that is the place or it was off this album? You need to check these things, but it's a pleasure, isn't it, presumably, because then you kind of jump into a pool of something. Suddenly you're in a soul mood for a day because something reminds you of Smokey Robinson or something like that.
Well, often, I don't know how it is in film so much, but often musicians these days don't really like to reveal their influences or their references, which I think is a shame, because the wonderful thing about artists and musicians is that they're a filter for all of this cool stuff, music, film, art, pieces of art, places, history that you don't have time to go and research. So it's almost like they're giving you a sort of clipboard with bullet points of all this cool stuff that you should go and check out. So this is just my little plea, I suppose. If there's any musicians or artists listening to this, is don't be afraid of talking about your influences.
Yeah, like any good maths exam, always show your workings. You get extra points.
I think it's a real pleasure being able to go off on all those tangents. I mean, I always do that with when I write about film, a bit of music will come into it, or likewise with writing about Anna Calvi. And also, I was lucky enough to be down in Brighton over the weekend, so I was just walking down to the sea, listening to the album with the stormy sky. and the Brighton sky has kind of influenced Nick Cave, so there are all these different links.
We've come full circle. I can hear seagulls and rolling thunder and gravel being raked by the waves. That brings us to the end of today's programme. Hunter by Anna Calvi is out now on Domino Records, and you can catch a performance by Anna in the Monocle Studios on our live music show The Sessions at Midori House this Thursday. Thanks very much to my guests today, Kate Hutchinson and Sophie Brown, and of course to my producer Holly Fisher. I'll be back next week to review Only to Sleep, the latest Philip Marlowe novel, talking of gender stereotyping, that's written by Lawrence Osborne. But until then, from me, Robert Bound, thank you very much for tuning in.